Welcome in to Studio 3 for Studio 2. I'm Cherry Gregg.
3, 4, 2. Those numbers are out of order. I'm Avi Wolfman-Aaron. So obviously the big story today, and we're working to confirm this at WHYY. Last night, the sky emitted a clear liquid that fell onto the ground.
Oh,
and
yes.
It's being called rain. Like I said, we're working to confirm that this actually happened. But if we have updates on that, we will bring it to you throughout the hour. But today we're actually not going to talk about the news.
No.
Sorry,
we're not. We're going to take a break from the news.
A break from the news.
Block out the noise.
We have three guests this hour, and we're going to kind of introduce them one by one, who have overcome tremendous odds in their life and really found passion and purpose.
Yes, right. And peace.
And peace. The three Ps, I call them.
The three Ps. That's right.
So, and as we give you their stories throughout the hour, we really want to hear from you. And audience participation is crucial this hour.
Mm-hmm.
Big or small, what are you doing right now to stretch yourself and to grow? What's motivating you? What are you doing to find the three Ps? Passion, purpose, or peace? Give us a call. 888-477-9499. Email studio2@whyy.org.
So I asked myself this question.
Uh-huh.
And of course,
how did you answer yourself?
I get a lot of my purpose and passion from the work we do here at WHYY as a journalist.
Right on.
You know, being part of Studio 2. But the news had been so crazy that the P that I was lacking was peace.
Mm.
And so earlier this year, I took up gardening.
Mm.
And I built this whole garden on my rooftop. And when I tell you, it has been this place of peace and solace, and it's been just therapeutic.
That's
growing
great.
My little tomatoes and my little oblong shaped, you know, cucumbers and weird shaped cantaloupes. And it's been amazing. So that has brought me peace. So that gives you
that.
All our listeners an example.
That's
How about
template.
You?
Well, I was thinking, try this on for size.
Mm-hmm.
So in order to find your peace, you grew some peas.
Well, not peas, but you could have.
Got it. Okay.
Yeah. I grew some watermelon.
What am I doing? I'm not doing enough is really the answer.
Uh-huh.
My hobby historically has been watching the basketball. Watching
uh-huh.
basketball and specifically the Sixers. And they stink. And I'm very aggravated by
it. So you need to find some new peace.
I need to find some peace.
Yeah. And hopefully you'll be inspired today by our listeners and by our guests today.
Absolutely. Also, by the way, Thursday, we always end the week with a song picked by the listeners that's related to today's show. So this is sort of an esoteric topic. You can really go a lot of ways with it. So if you have a song that you think captures today's theme, send it to studio2@whyy.org before 12:30. Producer Paige is not in today.
No, but
so she will not pick the winner. But executive producer Kevin will.
Uh-oh. Kevin is the curator of DJ of the day.
That's
a lot of pressure,
It's
Kevin.
A wild day. It's a wild day. It's raining. Who knows what will happen?
But we have our trio of stories. Let's
Start
give the
off.
Number one more time.
Oh,
888-477-9499 or email studio2@whyy.org. What are you doing to find passion, purpose, or peace? So we're going to start with the Pennsylvania Supreme Court. This story caught my eye because the high court shot down yet another attempt by Philadelphia officials to create their own gun laws here in the city.
Mm.
You may know this. Pennsylvania law prohibits municipalities from passing their own gun ordinances. In this case, which was filed in 2020 by the Kinney administration, city lawyers argue that the state law preemption on gun laws violated Philadelphia residents' right to liberty and life, given the scourge of gun violence that the city was dealing with and the failure by state lawmakers to pass stricter laws on their own. But the court was not swayed.
Not at all.
Unanimously, they said that despite the issues that the city is facing, those arguments fell woefully short of the standard needed to overcome, you know, this preemption for legal victory. And for years, you know, I covered gun violence in the city, Avi, and, you know, the city has repeatedly tried to pass laws mm-hmm. that would, you know, ban assault-style weapons, put limits on gun purchases in the city. Also, they wanted to ban guns in parks and in rec centers. And the high court has said no dice.
Yeah.
And so the only way to change this is to change state law.
Federal law supersedes state law. state law supersedes local law.
Yeah, that's the rule.
As it has been, as it will always be. And that is the case here.
Mm-hmm.
The state constitution says you can't do it.
Yeah.
Philadelphia can't do it.
Yeah, they'll need a constitutional amendment, which is hard. So,
speaking of the federal government, recently, Sarah McBride of Delaware became the first transgender person elected to Congress. She will be the sole representative in Congress, in the House of Representatives, from the great state of Delaware. Republicans in that chamber have responded by passing, by proposing laws and rules that would prohibit her from using women's bathrooms in the Capitol. There was then a response from John Fetterman, the U.S. Senator from Pennsylvania, saying that McBride is welcome to use his personal bathroom. And, of course, he hit back at Republicans who have tried to target McBride with this flurry of legislation and rules. So giving you the update on that, because that story has been evolving for about a week and we just had not touched on it yet here at Studio 2.
Yeah, you know what? This whole bathroom thing reminded me, and I mentioned this in our chat earlier this morning, this reminded me of the scene in the film Hidden Figures, where actor Taraji P. Henson, who plays Katherine Johnson, a black woman who worked at NASA in the early 60s, when bathrooms were segregated by race and gender. And there's this scene where she was gone for like 40 minutes, came back. Her boss says, "Where have you been? You disappear every day. What are you doing? I put all this faith in you." And she says, "There is no bathroom over here for me. And I have to go a half a mile anytime I have to use the bathroom." And that was the first time her boss had ever heard that. He tore down the segregated bathroom signs. And I know that people feel some kind of way about this. This is not exactly the same, but that scene came to mind as soon as I heard about this story.
Memo to Congress, work on a real problem.
Yes.
And now to story three.
Yes, a new report from This Old House looked at migration patterns in the United States and found that Philadelphia, guess what, is getting an influx of Gen Z residents. At the same time, though, millennials, Gen X, and boomers, they are all leaving for warmer climates.
Okay, break it down.
First of all,
can we just say, I'm just amused that this is a report from This Old House. I love This Old House.
Great, old house.
A stalwart member of the PBS public media family.
I know. Yeah. We got it. That's why we had to mention this.
Yeah.
That's why we had to mention this.
I didn't know they did reports.
Yeah, but apparently they do. And this one says, in 2023, Philadelphia added more than 20,000 Gen Z residents, roughly doubling the number of young people compared to the millennials of a decade ago.
Let me break that down.
Break it down.
So 10 years ago, there was a net migration of millennials to Philadelphia of about 10,000 residents. Net migration. So 10,000 more moved in than moved out. In 2023, among Gen Z residents, there was a 20,000 net migration. So a doubling of the net migration over 10 years. So apparently, we are a beacon
for
Gen Z in a way
we
were not for millennials.
Welcome, Gen Z.
I'm working on your slang. You have much riz. You are not sus, et cetera, et cetera.
I love that.
I want to welcome
you
Gen
know what?
Z
That's
into,
what we yeah. need to do. We got to include more Gen Z
voices.
Yeah, voices. And also, language that they understand, like you said, sus,
yeah.
all of that. So that, you know,
that's
we
what I'm doing.
Them. Yeah, I love it.
And our ratings just through the roof with Gen Z just because of that.
And as far as older generations, some of the cities that they are moving to, Jacksonville, San Diego. That's where all the millennials are going.
Really?
Gen X and boomers, they're moving to Florida and Texas. So, yeah. And by the way, New Jersey has seen a big loss in Gen Z with a net loss in 2023 of 19,000 people.
So Gen Z doesn't like New Jersey.
No.
And it's because they
like in Philly.
They were born after the Sopranos. So they didn't get that. You know what I mean?
Sopranos.
So millennials, we grew up with the Sopranos. Gen Z, not so much.
Not so much.
That's our music. Apparently, they're playing us out early in this segment. That's because the conversation was so good, Charlie.
I know. That's right.
But we're going to have a great conversation on the other side of this break.
And the question of the
yes.
day, big or small, what are you doing right now to stretch yourself and to grow? What's motivating you? What are you doing to find passion, purpose, or peace? Email studio2@whyy.org. We'll be right back.
Welcome back to Studio 2. I'm Avi Wolf-Nerin.
And I'm Cherry Gregg. Often on the show, we focus on the big news that everyone is talking about. But today we wanted to do something a little different, something deeper, something more personal.
Behind all the news and the headlines, we know people across our region wake up every day working toward finding meaning and purpose in their lives. So today, we are shining a spotlight on some folks who have overcome incredible odds to do exactly that. And we're hoping that their stories can serve as an inspiration to the rest of us.
Yeah, and we're also opening up the phone lines to you, big or small. What are you doing right now to stretch yourself and to grow? What is motivating you? And what are you doing to find the three P's, as we're calling it, passion, purpose, or peace? Call us. The number is 888-477-9499. The email studio2@whyy.org.
And this hour, a little different, we're going to introduce our guests one by one so we can hear their personal stories. So first up, just in time for the Philadelphia Marathon this weekend, we have Kellen Matthews Thompson right here in studio. He is an avid marathon runner who openly talks about his journey out of drug addiction. Kellen, welcome to Studio 2.
Thanks for having me.
So Kellen, you have overcome so much. You've racked up thousands of miles this year in running, but running serves a major purpose for you. So I want you to take us back to where you were, who you were before you found this passion.
Yeah. So as a young teenager, I was introduced to prescription painkillers. It was at a time in this country where the opioid epidemic was kind of just getting rolling. And it was a monster that was growing. And unfortunately, I was a victim to that. My addiction kind of progressed through high school into my late teen years, all the way up until I was 26 years old. At that point, I had come to the end of the road where it was either take my own life or try recovery and change my life around. So I hopped into a treatment facility. Luckily, I literally and figuratively hit the ground running when I got there. Fell in love with endurance and endurance sports. And I found that when I have something to fight for, like a run or a race, that I get some endorphins pumping in my body. And yeah, it's a similar high to what I was experiencing when I was using drugs. And thankfully, that has carried me a long way.
Wow. How was that connection made? Like, who introduced you to running, or how did you even start on that journey? What was the proverbial first step?
There was actually a doctor in the treatment facility that I went to. His name was Dr. Bender. And he sat like the quote-unquote class down in the treatment facility. They would take us through like some classes to like teach us different things about addiction or life skills. And the doctor sat us down and kind of explained the correlation between running and the brain and how runner's high kind of works, and that the brain essentially releases chemicals similar to opioids, morphines, and when you put yourself through something uncomfortable, painful, such as running, your brain rewards you by.
Did it just click for you immediately? You were like, yes.
Yeah, as soon as I.
So as soon as you heard it.
Soon as he used opioids and running in the same sentence, for some reason at the time that.
And so tell us about your running journey, because I don't know how great a shape you were in then when you started this, but how did you build it up, and what did running feel like in the beginning versus now?
Yeah, so I remember the first day that I went out for a run. At the time, I had a very unhealthy diet. I had gone from being very malnourished and skinny prior to getting into treatment to putting on some weight. I was able to like eat again, had a normal diet. So I was feeling very unhealthy, very overweight. The first time I went out for a run, it was awful. It hurt, my lungs burned, my legs were burning, and I could only run like less than a mile.
Wow.
And when I got out of treatment, I told myself that I was going to run 1 mile a day. And for the first like 8 months when I was in a halfway house, that's what I did. Every morning I woke up, I ran a half mile away and a half mile back. And I paired that with kind of going to the gym. 8 years later, I have run every distance from like your local 5K race to up to 100 mile races. This year, I
100
have...
mile. Okay, I just want to pause on that.
You do 100 miles.
That's a lot.
In one race?
Yes. Yeah. So the first time that I, we'll say the last 100 mile race that I did was actually a 24 hour race. It's right across the river. It's called Loopy Looper. They basically set a running clock for 24 hours. and you run this loop, a 4-mile loop, as many times as you can within that 24 hours. Whoever runs the most amount of complete laps within that 24 hours is crowned the winner. Mm. That day, I ran 108 miles in 23 hours and 25 minutes. At the time, I had set a course record and, yeah, came in first place.
Congratulations.
That is amazing. Yeah.
And so now you have a club.
Yes.
Where you're getting other people into this. Tell us a little bit about the effort and where it stands right now.
Yeah, so I have to give my wife a lot of credit on this because she was pushing me to get involved in the community and kind of share my love for running with other people. I was at a point where I was just like so focused on like trying to get better at running and be faster and run more races that I'm grateful that she kind of steered my focus towards community. We started back in March. We've had one event a month up until now, and it's consistently growing a little bigger and bigger.
It's called a club of people.
Yeah, it's called Recovery Run Club. You can find us on Instagram at Recovery Run Club. We invite anybody who's dealing with any sort of recovery. You could be recovering from literally anything, drug addiction, domestic violence, alcoholism, whatever it is. We have a community and we have someone there who has dealt with it. And yeah.
So tell us about this safe space and what it does for you and for the people who show up.
I think mostly outside of even the running thing, it gives people an alternate community to come to and find connection outside of just like your normal AA or NA fellowship program. This kind of is a group of people when you get there, you know, everybody is at least trying to get better at like something like running.
Yeah.
You have like a healthy lifestyle. You have that in common and hopefully a love for running. So if it's something that you're interested in, we'd love to have you guys out. And yeah, we'll see you guys there.
Yeah.
All right. Before we get to our next guest, let's bring in a caller.
Yes.
Because we've been asking you out there how you're finding passion and purpose and peace in this crazy world. So on line one, we have Sarah, who's found a way to cope. Sarah, you're on Studio 2. Tell us your story.
Okay, well, hello. And I had found myself stagnated in my career. I was living in Southern Oregon and was looking for a major life shakeup. I'd gotten laid off from a job. I had spent a year teaching in a subject I had no experience in, and was trying to figure out what I wanted to do next. And I was talking to my partner last Christmas, and I threw out an idea of applying for graduate school. So I applied to four different programs. I got into Villanova, and I was offered a scholarship, and we moved all the way across the country. So
Welcome. Yeah.
Thanks. I just turned 49. I am a lot older than everybody else in the program, and it's feeling daunting and exciting and overwhelming and all of those things that you hope it will be when you make a major life change. So I just wanted to say that to anyone that's thinking like they might be too old to try something, like you're just not. Yeah. There's no limit on there's no time stamp on when you can change your life and shake things up and try
awesome.
Something new. So
I love
Sarah, our newest wildcat
story. Yes. Yeah. And welcome to our area. We love having you. And if you want to join the conversation, what are you doing these days to find passion, purpose, or peace? Call us 888-477-9499 or email us your story at studio2@whyy.org. So now we want to introduce our next guest.
Yeah, let's do it. So in studio with us, we have award-winning chef Eli Culp. He is the host of the Delicious City Philly podcast and a chef and partner with High Street Hospitality Group. He was also paralyzed in the 2015 Amtrak train derailment and has had to rebuild his life after that crash. Eli, welcome to Studio 2.
What's up, guys? Great to be here.
Hey.
Bringing the energy. I like this.
I had to bite my tongue, Cherry, because when you said you discovered growing vegetables on your rooftop.
Yes.
Like, we're a kindred spirit. Because
what?
I have a great rooftop in Old City, and I have raised beds, and I'm growing, and this is just, they're like my children.
They are. Like, aren't they?
Ask anybody who knows me.
I got to know what's in this garden.
I have a specific pepper that I love called Aji Dulce. As a chef, I've used it when I was still up in New York. I discovered it. I have a true love for this pepper. It's fruity, it's flavorful, it's so unique. And I grew about almost 30 pounds of them this year.
OMG. I finally, what kind of fertilizer I finally, are you right. using, Eli?
Also, how big is this?
It's called bumper crop. It's wholly organic. But no, serious. I can go.
I'm writing this down.
We're not. It's not a garden show, is it? We don't need to go there.
We have done garden shows.
And then the Sixers.
And you are welcome.
Let's not even talk about the Sixers.
No, that's depression. We're trying to uplift this.
Exactly.
We're not doing the Sixers.
But you know what? Just hearing you, Eli, just describe the flavor of this pepper takes me to when I read about your story and you fell in love with food and cooking growing up in rural Washington State where there was no real restaurant except McDonald's. And then they opened one. You got on the staff. Tell us how you fell in love with food and cooking.
It was crazy. So, town of 500 people in the middle of nowhere, foothills of the Cascade Mountains. You said McDonald's, but you had to drive almost an hour to get to McDonald's.
What?
So it was no stoplights, one horse town type thing. And so, just fell in love with that area. You know, growing up there is such a beautiful area. I look back so fondly on it. And the thing was, I loved dirt biking. That was kind of a thing you did out there. Mm-hmm. And I wanted a dirt bike. I grew up really humbly. My dad worked in the logging industry. My mom didn't even work until like fifth grade. And so it was to say that we didn't have a lot of means, it would be an understatement. However, this lady moved into town from another larger city near Portland, Oregon, and decided to open up this really cute bistro. Mm. We're talking rednecks and hillbillies here, driving big trucks, hunting, fishing, right? This thing was out of place, but she wanted it. She wanted this country little cafe, bistro thing. And I got a job there as a dishwasher. And before I know it, I was busting tables. I was wearing a bow tie and a cummerbund, green, Irish green. Anyways, finally made my one night. It was really busy. We have a festival every year called the Blueberry Festival. And it was a big night, and they needed extra prep in the kitchen. So I was there until like 9 o'clock. I was cooking. I remember the first thing I cooked. It was teriyaki chicken salad.
Was it good?
It was a staple on the menu. It was the biggest seller. Mm. And I only got to cook it. You know, it was real basic, like, you know, soy sauce, sugar, chicken, diced chicken breasts. I guess you cut the one exotic piece was you cut the celery on a bias.
Ooh.
You didn't cut it straight. So it had that like Asian that flair to it a little bit. Bias is kind of like at an angle, like you shave it at an angle, right? And like that was really exotic. And then you added peanuts to it. So it was like over the top, right? So anyway, by the time I left high school, I stopped playing. I played once. I would always play sports. I decided, you know what, I'm going to play one sport each year. And I did that all through high school. So I would take a couple months off to do one sport. In the winter, I would ski because we were close to the mountains. And so by the time I left high school, I knew exactly what I wanted to do. So
and
I
it
moved
was
down
cooking.
To – what's that?
And it was cooking.
It was
being
cooking.
A chef. Yeah.
Yeah. And I never looked back.
And then fast forward, you work your way up in the food industry. You force yourself, and because of your friend circle, you become so creative and end up back here in the Philadelphia region where your family is actually from. And
exactly.
You become like this juggernaut in the food world here in Philadelphia.
Yeah. You know, I was up in New York City. I spent 10 years in New York. I always wanted to come out east to cook. I grew up in a small town. Something had, you know, whatever. I read the Anthony Bourdain book, Kitchen Confidential.
Yeah.
My brother got it for me. I was like, I'm moving to New York. I need to feel this energy. And so I went to New York, got right into it, spent almost a decade, 9.5 years up there. I got a call from a recruiter one day. I was looking to go to another job. I was looking for somewhere in New York. And he said, you ever think about Philadelphia?
You said no?
I was like, no, actually.
Of course. That's always the initial reaction.
No, it is.
And you like, got here.
And I'm not trying to sound like some pompous New Yorker. It's just when you're in New York, it's like when you're traveling, because so many people are not from there. So it's like you're going home. You're going to Europe. You're going to other places, right? You're not really taking weekend trips. I literally had one day off a week typically. Mm. So like it wasn't like I would be like, oh, let's plan a weekend, you know, getaway. And not only that, but I barely had any money because it was, you know, I'm working for – back then it was shift pay. You made $300 a week,
yeah.
Right? So anyways, got the opportunity. Ended up being Ellen Yin. Everybody knows Ellen Yin.
Yeah, we've had her on the show.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, you know, and she's still my partner today. She still lets me be her partner, I should say. we created this company called High Street Hospitality Group. Fork was already established, obviously. Then we opened up High Street next door to Fork, and that was a big hit. Got Bon Appetit magazine, best
big
new
awards,
restaurant in the country.
Magazines, everyone's lauding you and the restaurant group. And then you're going
to open. I just had to stop. Like, I had an amazing team. Yeah. Like, my team was killer.
Yeah.
So it wasn't just me. I just got lucky with these great people, and I had the privilege to lead them.
Yeah.
So.
And then you're going to open up an installation in New York City, sort of full circle.
Correct.
And that's why you're on the Amtrak train on that night in 2015.
Absolutely.
And that changes everything.
Yeah, I actually wouldn't have been down here because I was living in New York, so we were starting this new restaurant up there, and we were kind of dividing and conquer, Ellen and I. And you know, I came down to New York, or came down to Philly for the day. There's a one-off little thing I had to cook for. Took the earlier train home that I would normally. I would always take the 10:40 train. Or I guess it was 11 o'clock train. I'd leave work at 10:40. Took the 9 o'clock train that night. Wrong train to get on. Needless to say, my life changed within 8 minutes of that train leaving the station. It derailed in Port Richmond. I was flown across the train. I was right behind the business car. The business cars were, sadly, all those people died, and the biggest injuries were. I flung across the train car. I thought this was it. It went through my head. Like, this is it. That's the only word that went through my head. My neck slammed against the luggage rack on the opposite side as the train derailed to the right. I was on the left side, so I went airborne. Hit the ground, knew immediately I was paralyzed, and then started the recovery process.
Yeah, and Eli, first of all, I'm so sorry that happened to you. I remember covering this as a reporter on May 12th, 2015.
Can you believe it's almost 10 years now?
It's so hard to believe. It's so hard to believe. And so, you know, what you woke up at some point and realized the situation. You had been this top chef, living your dream, basically. How did you piece your life back together after, you know, losing some functioning, a lot of functioning in your body?
Yeah, I became quadriplegic. So I can't even use my hands to grab anything. You know, and being in a wheelchair, that's just not conducive to a small kitchen. You know, kitchens are always the last square footage that's squeezed into a restaurant, right? So there's never enough room in a kitchen already. And, you know, and it was interesting. It was this really kind of, you know, it felt like, you know, I got cut off at the knees, right? Like, I was just hitting my stride. Like, everything I put, those almost 20 years of work I was putting, you know, and just dedicated to the craft, love what I do every minute of it. And then it happening, and it was just really tough. And needless to say, unfortunately, I was going through a divorce right after, and my life really just came crumbling down around me. And I had completely lost everything, who I was. I didn't have I wasn't able to lead my team in the battle every day, and that's what I really was passionate. I love food, but I really loved the team. Yeah. I love being the coach.
The contact sport part of cooking.
Exactly. Yeah. Getting people, you know, rallying the troops to go into service, into battle. Like, it felt like a contact sport.
What was the beacon of light? And because I can only imagine the level of depression that you go into after such a tragic accident. What was that beacon of light that helped you?
It was a 3.5-year-old creature called my son, Dylan. Yeah. And I tell people all the time, if it wasn't for Dylan, I wouldn't be here today. I had a place. We were on the Upper East Side. I could go over to Randall's Island over this little bridge. There's a place where I could have easily just drove myself into the East River. I knew it. I looked at it. I stared at that place, like, many times. Of just knowing, like, I just pushed forward in my wheelchair, right? It got that bad. Mm-hmm. And it if it wasn't for him and – you know, and people like Ellen Yin, who really supported me no matter what. And honestly, the people of Philadelphia, like, they rallied around me. Mm. The amount of cards that were on my wall in the hospital room, like, I'm telling you, like, that wall to our right was covered with cards. There was a young girl, like, 3 years old, that emptied her piggy bank and sent me, like, $9.83. You know, and it was like, this is for you. You know, so, like, I did feel supported. I think once I got home from the hospital, that's really when it hit.
Yeah.
Because I was like, I wasn't around that. I wasn't around that support. And, you know, that's where it really got dark.
Before we transition, I want to mention that you're the host of the Delicious City Philly podcast and actually another podcast.
That's right.
You host more podcasts than we do.
Yeah.
There does seem to be – I'm curious if that is part of the healing, talking about your story but also just talking to people, like connecting with people in the way that you do through the course of an interview.
Well, you said the right word, connecting.
Yeah.
And that's really – human connection is so important. After about 3.5 years, I was in recovery, a lot of rehab and all that. We decided to move down to Philadelphia permanently, and I really felt like that was the right move at the time. I didn't know why, but I felt like I was around my people again, my teams. But when I got down here, it wasn't quite as I hoped. It wasn't like it just fit right back into things. So I did, again, found myself like wondering, like, what am I going to be doing, right? A friend of mine opened this little scrappy podcast studio, and one day he was giving me a tour, and I was like, oh, that's cool, whatever, and we left, whatever. And a couple days later, like, we connected, and the conversation started, like, what about a chef podcast, right? Mm. Like, and this was December of 2019. And so we started recording. I asked a couple of chef friends in Philly, they're like, hell yeah, let's do it. And so the I started recording, and then, of course, COVID was coming around the corner. And, so we kind of hit that timing right. So during COVID, people –
we all needed podcasts.
People, exactly. So long story short, I say podcasting saved me because it really helped me reconnect to the industry that I loved and the people that are important to me to keep in my circle and those conversations, because it really is about human connection. That's a big part of keeping your head above water.
And what was it like sort of redefining your space? Because you go from being a chef, and to now finding a whole new space where you're still able to connect with food. You're still able to do the thing that you love, but just in a different way.
Cooking came natural to me. It was just a natural thing. I didn't have to think about it. It just happened. It was, it's like that flow state you get into. You mentioned running, and that flow state you get into, and it's just a thing. Podcasting is not that.
Yeah,
it is me fumbling my way through it, figuring out how do you make this work financially? How do you make all this stuff work? I say it's an expensive hobby, but I always say just do something. Just act on something and a door will open. Walk through that door. Another door will open. Walk through that door. And just keep walking through these doors. Yeah. And it's amazing just acting on one thing, how it can lead to the next.
Yeah. And we want to note, if you're struggling and you're thinking about self-harm, there is help. The Suicide Prevention Lifeline is available 24/7, and 100%. The number is 988. I want to read a couple emails now because, folks, we put this prompt out there. Jeff says, my son became a runner at 18 after a long, hard, challenging struggle to get through school with ADHD and learning disabilities. It really enhanced his self-esteem and gave him something to work on and achieve. He is now a successful IT worker after earning a business degree and is in the 1% of runners in our area at 32 years old. My wife and I could not be more proud. Thanks so much for sharing that story, Jeff. And Jay says, I volunteer. Mm-hmm. That's how Jay finds the 3 P's. I'm currently on the Alaska Peninsula, I'm jealous, Jay, with U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. Been here for 2 months, finishing up this week.
Yeah, and we're about to go to a break, but we want you to join the conversation, right? Tell us, what are you doing these days to find passion, purpose, and peace? Tell us your story, 888-477-9499, or you can email studio2@whyy.org. And on the other side of this break, we're going to introduce our third guest, a woman who is a gun violence activist. She's been on the streets helping people deal with opioid addiction, but all of this sparked from her dealing with her own trauma. So she's going to share her story about how she found success despite all that she's been through. We can't wait to talk with Roz Pichardo after the break.
And welcome back to Studio 2. I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt.
And I'm Cherry Gregg. Today, given the crazy news cycle that we've been in recent months, we decided to take a break and block out the noise. We've brought in a few people from our region who have overcome incredible odds to find success.
Let me reintroduce our guests. Eli Culp is the host of the Delicious City Philly podcast and a chef and partner with High Street Hospitality Group. Eli suffered paralysis during the 2015 Amtrak derailment and has found a way to redefine his life and his passion. We also have Kellen Matthews Thompson, an avid marathon runner who openly talks about his journey out of drug addiction.
Now I want to bring in our third guest, Rosalind Pichardo, founder and executive director of the nonprofit Operation Save Our City, which works with families impacted by gun violence and the opioid epidemic. But Roz found her passion and purpose following major trauma in her own life. Roz, welcome to Studio 2.
Oh, I don't think we have Roz here with us right now. I'll mention as we try to get Roz back that we're opening up the phone lines to you this hour as well. Big or small, what are you doing right now to stretch yourself and to grow? What's motivating you? What are you doing to find passion, purpose, or peace? Call us. Our number is 888-477-9499. Let me read this email from Mary, who says, after being numb for about a week after the election, I'm engaging again, making calls to elected officials on particular subjects like the arena, volunteering at a local public school library to work with students, packing groceries for our food insecurity group, reading novels, and soon going to visit grandchildren in Vermont and D.C. Having a purpose gives me a sense of peace. So that's a great email from Mary.
By the way, Keisha says, what brings her purpose and peace? Cooking and eating.
Amen to that.
Keep it simple. Cooking and eating.
As we work to get Roz on the program, I would just love to hear, Kellen, like you had a chance to listen to Eli's story, and if there were things in there that you said, that
resonates.
That tracks, that resonates with me.
Yeah, I think it's I definitely resonate with the feeling of kind of feeling like everything is taken away from you, similar to his story where there was an accident and that was the tipping point in his life. Early on in my life, when I was 14, kind of had three things that were just like happened back to back to back that were just very traumatic for me. It was losing my father, the passing of my uncle, and then also losing like my aunt's river house where I spent a lot of my time as a kid. So at that moment in time, it's like I had to grow up really quickly. And when I did that, it just affected me in a negative way. And at that time, I was kind of coming into high school, coming into being a man, and I was just vulnerable at that point in time. And then I didn't have like a male positive role model or even really a positive role model in my life that was there to make a difference. And instead of going down the positive road where some people go, I found self-soothing in drug use. And yeah, that is a kind of snowball effect.
When you have the running club, how often, like, it feels like a very sort of like flexible and casual environment. So does it lead to conversations among runners about, you know, your past struggles with addiction or whatever recovery you're in? Or is it more of a space where it's like, we don't come to talk about that. We come to sort of heal together in an unspoken way.
I think it's a little bit of both. I think that when you get out on a run, it's just like naturally, especially when you're running with people, it's natural to just kind of start talking.
Yeah.
For me anyways, I find that when I'm running and talking, the run goes by so much faster. So I think naturally people are just kind of coming together, talking about either their past or kind of things that they're going through right then and there. And I think that Recovery Run Club gives an environment to just put your stuff out there with people who understand.
Totally.
Yeah. And now I want to reintroduce our third guest. We have Rosalind Pichardo, the founder and executive director of the nonprofit Operation Save Our City, who has personally had to reckon with the trauma of gun violence in her own life. Roz, you were on Studio 2. How you doing?
I'm doing good. Thanks for having me this morning.
Yeah. So, Roz, you are so well known in the city of Philadelphia with regard to your activism. Fighting gun violence, addiction, and providing harm reduction services. But take us back to the beginning. How did you decide to get involved in this work?
So very early on in my life, maybe about 16 years old, I had survived an attempted homicide by an ex-boyfriend after he himself had experienced gun violence and became very aggressive. I couldn't be with him. And when I left him, that's when the stalking began and all of these things. And we had broken up for a little while, and I started dating someone, and that was that. He didn't want that. You know, it was, if I couldn't have you, no one could. So he attempted to take my life by throwing me over a 40-foot bridge. I survived that, and then, like, later on that day, he murdered my then-boyfriend, Talver Jackson. So surviving that at 16 was traumatic, and then but what gave me a little bit of hope was that I was able to testify. I wasn't going to allow him to instill fear in my life. I know, mm-hmm. domestic violence happens all over the world, and it's hard to get out of when you know that person can be violent. But I didn't want that person to instill that fear in my heart, and I didn't. And was able to face him in court. He served some time in prison. And unfortunately, he was released from prison, and I had to face him again 15 years later after wow. he took the life of his girlfriend, Maria Serrano, from Reading, PA. And then later on in life, I lost my identical twin sister, Kathleen Pichardo, to a self-inflicted gunshot wound. And that tore me apart, and I didn't know how I was going to survive that. And, you know, just being part of her, I lost something in myself, and I had to find my way out of that dark place that I was in for.
And Roz, I want to ask you, thank you for sharing that, and I'm sorry about what happened to your sister and what happened to your boyfriend and what has happened to you. But somehow, some way, you found a way to channel that grief, channel a lot of that energy into helping others. What was the thing that made you say, you know what, I got to use this for something that is good?
I really needed to find that passion for healing from this trauma, because I knew that if I didn't find the way to heal from this pain, that I wasn't going to be able to help anybody else, because I knew that my purpose was serving. I just didn't know in what capacity. Because I knew the ins and outs of the system and what the systems were lacking, like, my mom needed help, we needed help, so we had to build that space to help each other out. And it just grew from there. I'm like, there's so many families, you know, who've experienced this kind of loss, but we had to navigate these systems that were hard to navigate, especially for Spanish-speaking families and things like that. So we created our own space and our own movement, and it just really took off. And then years later, my brother was gone to gun violence. So it's just evolved, and you know, just my purpose to serve and my passion to heal, and that's what really brought the community and the people together.
Yeah, and just quickly, I mean, you've done things to help people in so many ways, from writing and speaking to working directly with gun violence victims. You've been on trains helping to save people in active addiction, providing Narcan on the streets. Tell a little bit about what it is you actually do for folks who may not know.
So I run a nonprofit called Operation Save Our City. Our location is the Sunshine House in Kensington. So essentially a space where people can come in and receive services. We have case managers there to help you out with ID, to help you go into housing, recovery. We have an art space. We have nurses on board. We have so many things happening. And open mic night, it seems to be our place where people bring that love and
open
that peace.
Night.
And yeah, that jam session that happens. It's such a beautiful space and a beautiful connection that they can bring back home. If they so choose to go into recovery, we've created that soft connection back home to their families. We receive over 400 calls, and people have their little mailboxes. They check in with their families, and, oh, my mom is looking for you. You know, that kind of thing. It's just like, you know, sometimes our sunshines have a tendency of burning bridges, right? So that soft rebuilding of that bridge, so that when they go into recovery, the talking and the conversation has already started for folks. Mm. So, yeah, getting folks reconnected back home, especially during the holidays, is so key.
Yeah. Roz,
when I read your story, the biggest question I had was, when something bad happens to a person, I feel like there is an impulse to turn inward. Mm. And for you, it feels like the impulse was the opposite, to like turn outward, to help other people. How do you explain that?
You know, I've been trying to figure that out. Mm. I think that because my pain ran so deep, it needed to come out.
Yeah.
And this is the way that it does. It's serving. And I normally find my peace by just reflecting all that I've been through. But I don't want to hold on to that space too long in the morning. I deal with it in the morning because I did experience a mental loss. But it's like in the morning, that 5 minutes, that 10 minutes. But that's all it gets, because we have work to do. We have a crisis to deal with. We have an epidemic of gun violence that we have to deal with. But, you know, there's reflection. It has to be intentional in the morning for me.
Yeah.
For me to go on with my day, it has to be intentional. Yeah. And that's where I allow that space to heal, to reflect, so I can continue to do my work.
Yeah, I want to read a comment. Tina from Bucks County says, she makes it her mission to talk to one new person, start a conversation by telling them something positive, to not only make the life of that person better and happier, but also to enrich herself on human connection. And I really like that. John from Collegeville joined hurricane rescue efforts in North Carolina and found purpose through helping fellow Americans. He's about to go down there again and continue helping people who were hit by the hurricane. So I want to open this conversation to all three of you right now and just talk about folks. I mean, folks, people have been in dark places. The news has been crazy, right? Maybe they've had something happen in their life. Give some advice. Like, how do you sort of pull yourself out of this and find purpose or passion or peace? How do you do that, Eli?
Well, you said one thing that I've had to really eliminate out of my life. And it's, unfortunately, it's the news.
Mm.
You know, the election cycle was vicious. It was in your face constantly, the text messages, the calls, the commercials. I mean, the commercials, like, I wanted to not even let my son watch TV because the appalling nature of them and the scare tactics and all these things. And kids were young kids were learning words they shouldn't learn just because of political ads. And the news is so addicting. It's like an endorphin hit, right?
Yep.
And it's so easy just to go on your phone and click that app. But I realized that doesn't bring me peace. In fact, it does the opposite. It distracts me from the things that I need to do in order to have that peace and feel that I have hope, because it can feel very hopeless.
Mm-hmm.
And sure, it's good to stay informed and all of that.
And we hope you continue to listen to Studio 2.
Yeah.
I just want to put that out there.
That's so fair, though. That's,
but well, you don't mean Studio 2. So
no, you guys, the stuff you do.
Thank
is
you.
Amazing.
Carve out.
Yeah.
No, but before we do have to wrap up, I just want to make sure we get a chance for our other two guests to have like a final thought. Because I would imagine people do turn to you and say, you know, how did you do it? And then, like, what do you tell them? Or do you maybe not try to tell them too much because you don't know how transferable your experience is?
Well, I think that's the thing, especially with my issue that I had at hand, like addiction. I don't think there's one size fits all.
Yeah.
I don't think recovery is one size fits all. It's a little different for everybody. So the best thing I can do is share my experience, strength, and hope and let you know, like, hey, listen, this is what I did for me, and this is what has and what is working for me. And for me, it's doing something hard, challenging myself every day, sweating, getting my heart rate up, and kind of getting those endorphins flowing allows me to think clearly, and it allows me to be the best version of me that I need to be for everybody else.
Yeah.
You're nodding along, Eli, as well. And Roz, real quick, I wanted to get your thoughts on that final question.
For me, it's just serving and just reminding people that a lot of my sunshines in Kensington deserve love, and that's what brings me healing is – it's loving on people and to be everly so kind to people who are forgotten, who are hated on, you know, just love people unconditionally. And I promise you'll be loved back.
And by the way, you use the term sunshine. Please quickly tell people why.
Well, sunshines, you know, people call them junkies and addicts and zombies. They're not that. They're humans. They're my sunshines.
Mm, beautiful.
Beautiful.
Yeah. Thank you so much, Roz and Eli and Kellen. It's been a pleasure to talk with you this hour. We do have to close the show, even though we could go on and on. I did want to mention Janet's prescription was she's going to visit all 54 libraries in Philadelphia.
Oh.
I love that. I love a concrete goal like that. That's so cool. We also want to mention our Studio 2 DJ of the day.
I'm going to give you a little.
Do you want me to say it?
I'll let you. Yeah, I'm giving you drum roll.
So our DJ of the week is Kevin from Hellertown, and his pick is Who Will Stop the Rain by Creedence Clearwater Revival. Works on a couple of levels today. Let's hear that song as we go out today. CCR. There it is. Long as I remember, rain's been pouring down, Cherry.
I love it. And thank you to our guests, but also thank you to our producers, Debbie Builder, Paige Murray Bessler, and Andreas Copes, Diana Martinez. Thanks for engineering today's show. Our executive producer is Kevin McCrory. The general manager of audio here at WHYY is Joan Isabella. From Studio 3 for Studio 2 at WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Cherry Gregg.
I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt. We will talk to you next week.